to Forge the Narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to the post-preview show of Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. I'm joined tonight by Adam Camilleri.
Take me down to the Hobby City where the flock is green and the models are pretty.
We are the Metal Lost Souls podcast. I need to talk about this big bad leather daddy.
When you said that to me, the first thing I said was, wow, they've brought Imperial Knights to Age of Sigmar because those are some big, big boys.
Well, this, you know, we primarily talk about Warhammer 40K, but Age of Sigmar, where they've brought in what they're calling the Mega Gargants, which are these world titans, essentially, Baphomet is the world titan, and these are like his chief avatars, really. Like, it's like a giant. It's like a Castellan knight. To me, it actually looks bigger. Like, I don't know what the size of the current Sigmar giant is, how it compares to a titan. I feel like it has to be a tad bit smaller since it's on a different base, but these guys, gigantic.
They're huge. I'm a big fan of the sculpts. I think they're gorgeous looking things. I'm a bit interested in how broad they seem to be. Like, they do seem to be of a size comparison with Imperial Knights. I don't think they're quite as girthy. Like, if you look at, when you get an Imperial Knight and you look at it from the top down, like you look at it from the carapace down, you can barely see any base. It's just as wide as the base that it's on. These guys look like they're, you know, they're of a scale properly. They look fantastic. Actually, they look incredible. I'm looking at them right now. Super, super, super awesome.
The thing that jumps out at me, just initial impressions of the kit as a builder, as a modeler, I know friends are going to get this kit, is that all three options come in the same kit. So you're going to get all the bits from the stuff you don't use. And these are going to be, I mean, just think about it. If you build the guy with the club, then you get the net, the fishing net with all the stuff in it as just something you can use in another piece. You get the hanging corpses or the big hand holding the human and stuff. All that stuff in the kit that you can use somewhere else. So there's going to be a lot of value here.
It really sounds like they're paid homage to the original Giant kit. Because that original Giant kit, I know so many mates when I was playing Fantasy that bought that kit for all the bits. That had the dude, that had the poor dude in the cage, the cow you could throw or put it on a catapult, had the guy running away, had all those bits and pieces you could use to enhance other models in your army. And it sounds like they paid homage to that by, in this kit, just giving you so much extra stuff. I think that's brilliant by J-Dub.
Yeah, and the heads, the different heads. I mean, I bet you're going to see people mixing this kind of stuff up. Like, you know, look at your model, build it however you want, right? I bet we're going to see some amalgamations of the three different things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Get some pretty like, inspired stuff.
They're all like hobo grandpas. Here's your selection of hobo grandpas. You choose wisely.
They did come right out and say that you're going to be able to fill this as a standalone army. And if you're looking like one of the main things I hear about folks in their fantasy battle, I know we can't, you know, it's not called fantasy battle anymore, but when they think about that, they think about, oh man, just all the regiments and the legions of models and stuff. I just don't know if I want to do that, but I love the environment, I love the lore or whatever. Mm. And now you're going to get a full-on certified, supported way with brand new models of how to play it with five models.
Man, I played all the way through 8th edition fantasy. I got the tail end of 7th edition all the way through 8th edition. And man, they, like, GW really knocked up the size of armies. They, like, really, they went to the horde size so you could go 10 wide, 3 deep, and you'd be a horde unit. And they really wanted you to make big, chunky, fleshed out armies. But they became very intimidating for new people trying to play the game when you realize, oh, well, I have to paint. You're telling me I have to buy four boxes of $58 great swords to make one unit of great swords,
die before they even swing. Like that was do the anything. Thing. Anything at all, then you are putting them back in the box. And it was, but you know what the weird thing is? Some people miss that.
I do. I still miss that. But I can see as a new player joining into that game, you're like, that buy-in is erroneous. That was really intimidating. I do see how they've tried to make things differently with Age of Sigmar, and I really appreciate that.
It's a lot more accessible. I do think as a whole it is more accessible.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Although they have, again, like everybody in Age of Sigmar seems to be getting a way to summon or get reinforcements during the game. So they are, again, like trying to, it's like they're trying to do a sideboard. I know you and I, I've been playing a little bit of Magic Arena. You were talking about playing some before. It's like they're not quite trying to do a sideboard, but it seems like they're trying to give everyone the option to kind of not quite tailor mid-game, but be more flexible.
Yeah, I don't mind that. You know, you're talking about missing those ranks and stuff. I did just the thrill of getting a side or a rear charge on people just routinely, you know, just because you were good at the game is very exhilarating.
It's I couldn't agree more, mate.
But that's actually, if we can, let's table that just a bit, because I want to talk about that movement and stuff later on in the show about 40K. I know we're talking about the preview and stuff. I don't want to sidetrack us too much, but I know you got some thoughts on movement in 40K. But with these giants and just with the ability, it sounded like that you could add them to many different types of armies. So not just giants, not just order. You know, it seemed like you could put them in several of the Grand Alliances.
Really? I would assume they were just in Destruction, but naturally, I didn't watch it, so you'd know better than I would.
Well, they weren't like super clear on it, and it may have been somewhat speculative in their comments as well. But to me, the impression that I got is that this was not just a Destruction thing.
Mm. No, but, that's good.
Yeah, we'll see, right?
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, anytime, I wouldn't blame them for trying to be able to get these centerpiece models out there, you know, people have put the options of using them as many things as they possibly could. So, you know, there is that, but I got the distinct impression from some of their comments that this might be available to different grand, you know, multiple, more than one Grand Alliance.
That would be interesting if they did that. Well, like, so like a mercenary thing. I mean, technically you look at things like, you look at what, Knights represent in 40K, and they, I mean, you have Imperial Knights, you have Chaos Knights, essentially three quarters of the factions in 40K, you know, Space Wolves, Imperial Guard, Chaos Space Marines, Demons, have access to a Knight equivalent model. They have access to Imperial Knights, they have access to Chaos Knights. Like three quarters of all the factions have access to this level, this scale of model. Mm-hmm. That could be an interesting way they go with this, trying to cover a lot more of their bases and trying to diversify, because if it came into the game, that's, let's say, one super good army already. Let's say Space Marines, yeah? If let's say, I don't know where the meta of Age of Sigmar is. I get some whispers and I try and keep up with it where
it's
I can.
It's pretty much also Space Marines.
Yeah, well, exactly. Like if you gave Sigmarites, if you just gave Sigmarites an Imperial Knight, you know, that's taking one of the best armies in the game and just taking them up another level. If you're bringing something that polarizing into the game, you want to be able to give it to as many different armies as possible so it doesn't become something that just dominates and is erroneous. Remember how the game was when flyers first came in 5th edition? When your army, the opponent's army had a flyer and you're like, my army doesn't have a flyer, I think I might be screwed.
Yeah.
Especially when your opponent was like, had 3 Helldrakes, the jerk.
Yeah, or Necrons with 5 or 6 of those things.
6 of croissants, doom croissants. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was just a bad, bad time. That could, you know, that could be something that unfortunately happens in Age of Sigmar if they just give like super, super, super powerful polarizing units to one faction.
That's not how Sigmar works, though. If I can just kind of expound on this, at least what I know. Like I do play the Lumineth Realm Nords are really calling me. I've got, that would mean I just basically have all the elf factions.
You just want some fancy, fancy goat boys, don't you?
We're going to talk about that model they just spoiled, you know, man. Whatever, I don't want to jump the gun, but in Sigmar, that things, you roll differently. Like you're not trying to wound against someone's toughness. The model has I wound on this, and so you know we hear about how las guns and things can kill everything in 40K, but in this case, like you know what your wound roll is, like so the thing is really unassailable. You know, there's your unit will perform in a way, and you can put damage on things. Now they may have a ton of wounds and defenses or ways to ignore things. I mean, I don't know. We know nothing of their stats, but just saying that I don't think they're going to be as polarizing as you may be describing.
Yeah, well, that was just a concern, seeing as something that happens in some things that have happened in 40K. But yeah, of course, like Age of Sigmar is a whole different beast, and who the hell knows what these things are going to represent. But I'm a fan. I like what they're doing. I think it's cool.
Well, I mean, it's of course they're knocking it out of the park with all the sculpts. I am really interested to seeing, you know, how these do fit into Sigmar, because this is the type of thing, like, again, if somebody's on the fence and, you know, how many people do you know went and rushed and bought all the knight armies because the knights look so cool? Like, you know, I mean, tournaments had to react. They didn't want knights to be there, but they couldn't stop them because everyone had them and they were so cool looking.
And everyone wanted to play them. Yeah. Everyone wanted to play knights. And you can't just be like, okay, we appreciate that everybody has gone out and bought $500 worth of knights, but you're not allowed to play them.
Yeah,
like, well, what is that? Right. That's just not the community we are.
The rules, but I mean, really, to be fair to the tournament organizers, I was one included back then, is that the missions weren't suited to kind of deal with knights being there. Like, a lot of the missions we had at the time were difficult to score, you know, like, because there were things you had to put in things in your things or rules into your missions that were like, unless it's a knight or this. So there were all these exceptions that had to be there, and it was just kind of clunky. And then not everyone, you know, could take 8 melted guns or whatever, you know, who knows. But with the thing, it was just a lot. There was a lot going on that they were just so weird and so polarizing at the time.
On top of that, literally some factions just couldn't kill like 3 knights in a game.
Yeah.
But those 3 knights at the time, especially in, I don't want to say they were more polarizing in 7th editions than they are in 8th. Because like you said, in 8th edition, everything can hurt a knight technically. Whereas in 7th edition, like, oh, you didn't bring massed strength 6, 7, 8 shooting, you can't kill a knight.
Your very well themed Kroot army has no prayer of doing that.
That's exactly right, mate.
I don't think we're there in Sigmar. You know, with my, you know, I don't claim to be a competitive Sigmar player. I just know that things are a lot killy. Like you really do have things. You know, even the mega models get brought down, you know, by things, and like Archeon, you know, those kind of things, they still die.
Yeah, they're exactly right. They are of an ilk of Magnus and Mortarion. They're big, polarizing and fearsome things, but they don't in themselves walk out and just kill a whole army by themselves. I know there was some broke stuff that I know that Nagash could do. I mean, Nagash's coin flip thing, where it's like, pick my hand, a hand of dust. You just pointed a model and like, it died or didn't die. Yeah, that was a fun one.
Yeah.
And there were some issues there. And that was when I was playing Age of Sigmar. Nagash was a big issue. And that was like in the first year. But yeah, I think they've done a really good job. Like, I don't see, apart from things like Nagash, and I think Marathi is another one as well, they're big keynote models don't seem to be as prevalently taken as things like Illimon and Magnus Morty. I know the who's the big bad battle cabbage?
That's the orc, the orc thing, yeah.
So the battle cabbage is the.
I actually had no idea what you were talking about, but the only thing I can think of that looks like a cabbage is that orc thing.
Yeah, it is. You haven't heard of being called the battle cabbage before?
I haven't, but that seems to be very appropriate.
It's so apt. that's the orc maw crusher.
Yeah,
the named orc maw crusher. No one ever takes him because apparently the generic guy is just better. Well, he gives you pretty much all the good bits that he does, but he's a lot less points. That seems to hold true for Archaon as well. I haven't heard of any of my Age of Sigmar mates like being super keen on Archaon, even if they are like diehard Chaos players. I think I've heard Marathi's pretty good though, but I'm not quite sure about that. And her model, wow! If they ever needed something to model Fulgrim off, just look at that. That model's stupendous.
Yeah. I'm surprised we have not seen more Fulgrims, you know, just made out of that thing.
Yeah, me too. Oh, there's a couple of Kingdom Death models that could be very good Fulgrims, or a couple of different Primarchs, give or take. I think there was one of my mates, he put it, this was ages ago, I think one of the first released Kingdom Death stuff. He said this could be a great Angron. I can't remember what model he was showing me though.
Oh, this is a beautiful model. This is a beautiful model range too.
Oh, yeah, stupendous.
I guess, you know, with this, you know, we can jump to the next topic, but I think this will be welcome for Sigmar players. I mean, new faction, right? I mean, that's kind of, you know, it's going to have its own rules. People are going to want to play it. And I just don't think that the environment is going to be upset by this. I think it's going to be a big compliment to it.
Oh, I wasn't trying to make out that anybody was going to be upset. I was just saying how G-Dub have probably been very clever in what they're doing in trying to balance things out. And plus, who's going to be upset about a brand new range of models with ridiculously awesome, beautiful sculpts? Like, you just can't be angry. Like, you're just like, I want to dislike this, but I can't because the models are freaking amazing. So, yeah.
Same way with those, man. I just can't wait to harvest bits. Like, I'm already thinking about things like I can do. Like, I'm building all this Necromunda scenery and stuff. I'm like, man, in this little meat market here, that net with the things hanging out of it would be amazing.
Meat market. That's so good.
I can't wait. Oh, so the next thing on the list is the Blackstone Fortress. This is, they said it was the last is the final installment of this section of the Blackstone Fortress.
Yep. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they move on to something, a different kind of Blackstone Fortress scale-ish game from this, like just in a different setting or whatever, a different range of heroes. Because from what I can tell, Blackstone Fortress has been hugely successful.
Yeah, well, the figures are, this is some, you know, they also previewed the Inquisitor for 40K.
Yes, that is an OG. OG is OG Inquisitor. He's got his old school third edition.
Well, it's a she, Draxus.
It is a she. Apologies. Yeah. And she's got her third edition shuriken catapult going, and her Eldar is an Eldar-esque armor. I'm just gonna pull her up quickly.
Yeah, very very Eldar flow to the like the boots and stuff, especially like those are, you know, Baharoth's legs.
Yeah, it's true. Actually, I'm just pulling her up now. Man, those sons of Behemoth! Wow,
I mean, if I had to guess, you know, like the skulls, like Exodite Eldar, I don't know enough about the character to comment. But where I'm going is, I love the Inquisitor type stuff from 40K. Like there was that time where Kodiaz was really popular, and you could take a bunch of Inquisitor stuff competitive wise in 40K. I think that was what, 5th, 6th edition type thing.
Yep.
And I loved that. I love the character that the Inquisitors bring to 40K, and we've got a lot of that, of those types of characters in the Blackstone Fortress. Heck, I even picked up that combat arena game just for the 5 figures inside. You can get it from Barnes & Noble for, I think it's $37, $38 or something like that, and you get 5 character models that if you were to buy them separately from GW, they'd be at least $20 a piece.
Yeah. Agreed. Yeah.
So I'm a little bit of an aside, but I love the look of those models, and that's why, you know, I'm drawn to the Blackstone Fortress stuff as well.
I'm just looking at that Inquisitor, and yeah, so apparently there is a lot of fluff behind this character. One of my mates in my little chat, he brought it up, and he was saying this is is it a renegade? I think he said it was a renegade Inquisitor, or is it just like ergo similar to Celestine? You know, Celestine's, she's kind of viewed with both suspicion and like awe because technically people think she's a mutant because she's got wings and such, and you know.
Well, the one that was it? What's her name? Ethereal from Demonifugue and her Harlequin buddy. You know that they're actually walking together in the preview shot. So these are folks that exist on the fringe. You got some good stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And there's all that was exactly where I was going with this. There is so much more depth to 40K than just what you see on face value. Like just it's the Imperium versus Chaos and Imperium versus Xenos and the Xenos versus Xenos. And then there's all this fringe stuff, which I think is actually kind of where they here's a really interesting perspective on 40K and how they started writing it and creating it, because they started with the fringe stuff. They started with the rogue traders.
With Inspector Obi-Wan Kruslow or whatever.
Yeah, they wrote around the fringes of the Imperium. They started with the rogue trader-esque ideas and concepts of his. There's this big like bureaucratic entity, a galaxy-spanning bureaucratic. Mm-hmm. And here's these guys, you know, Firefly-esque, trying to forge their own way in this unit, in this galaxy. There's so much character on that fringe. There's so much interest and so many different perspectives and things you can find on that fringe of the whole game. And I just love that they're bringing homage and bringing our attention back to the fringe with characters like this Inquisitor and like with Demifuge as well. I think it's incredible.
Yeah, the neat thing about the Inquisitors is that they can, like, their rules are even in, they can ride in other people's transports and stuff, because they get to flash their badge and be like, yo, my word is law, right? No one can say anything to me. And that's why, you know, just slap an Imperial seal on that shuriken catapult, you know, and
they've got a book written by like the High Lords of Terror that says, no, only this guy's shotgun matters. If he says shotgun, no one else gets to say shotgun. He vetoes all other shotguns. So you're trying to go shotgun with your brother. You're like, hey, man, I'm going to go shotgun. And Quiz Rock's up. Nah, mate.
No,
nah,
trying mate. To shoddy. Sneak it in first. No touching the doorknob. Shoddy, yeah. No spelling
get in
it.
Get in the back, kid. I shoddy this. Yeah.
But I mean, back to the Blackstone Fortress, when they previewed the, you know, what the big drone, I'm like, man, that is a giant drone in the picture. Like, I don't remember it being that big. Turns out they're not. These are big old drones that hold the other.
How big are they? Because I mean, the regular drones, they're about the size of a guardsman. Yeah.
Yeah, I think these are on dreadnought bases. So I think they're on the 60 mil bases. So you know, it looks like they're I mean, I don't know, probably as tall as a Telamon or something. I mean, just going completely on looks, and then just the scale of the Inquisitor there with his pistol out. And then we see, you know, what's his name from the original set, who you defeat at the end of the original game. He's back in this.
Yeah, good call.
They hinted at that stuff in the preview. I'm not making too much of an assumption here, but I don't know of any other Chaos Lords with a top nut and a Thunderhammer, and he's on the front of the box. So
yeah, exactly right. I'm actually looking at this Psychic Awakening Pariah. So the thumbnail for the video is this Inquisitor. Is it Draxus?
Yep.
What's the name of this Inquisitor? To her right looks like a Sister of Battle wielding two swords.
That's Ethereal or whatever. The one to the left, that's the Sister of Battle from Demonifuge. And then Demonifuge, the right is the Harlequin guy that she travels around with.
That's what I was about to say. Yeah, it looks like they've got a trio here of fringe characters. Now to the right of those is Ultramarines. They've got some blue boys standing up on a cliff. And to the left of them, they've got Sisters of Battle. And we know that the bad guy the enemy in this one is the Necrons. But I'm curious to see. Very happy to see Sisters here. I'm also pretty keen to see what they do with Inquisition, because they could also very well be. Essentially, this could be a Agents of the Imperium kind of mini decks in here. There could be Custodes, Sisters of Silence, and Assassins and such. But the fact that there's Space Marines there as well does me a little concern.
Well, the Ultramarines have a huge history with the Necrons. Nightbringer woke up on their planet. Maybe not theirs, but a planet they were inhabiting. There's this really popular Ultramarine story. I did not read it because
it's Ultramarines. Why would you want to read Ultramarines, Matt?
I know a lot of people did, and I've of course been told the story. That was like one of the big like plot shifting stories. Back when the plot was basically frozen, you didn't see any movement in the story.
Yes.
That was one of the ones that pushed it along, inched it,
I really enjoy it. So there was a bunch of fluff and stories. It was Kalgar in the First Company versus, is it Behemoth or was it Leviathan that went through Ultramar?
That's a good question. I think it's Leviathan.
Well, whichever one was the first one?
Which is the purple one? Is the purple one Behemoth?
The purple one's Leviathan. Behemoth is the red and red and green.
I think it's the purple one.
Yeah, so then it'll be Leviathan. Yeah, and I could read about Kalgar getting both his arms chopped off by the Swarm Lord all day. But I had a problem with Ultramarines fluff. I used to try and read it, and it'd be like they just didn't – nothing seemed to actually bother them. No matter what happened, they just beat it, overcame it, and they were all good at the end. They're all high-fiving. I'm just like, where's the struggle? I'm like, where's the plight? And it's like, I'm reading Ultramarine stuff, and I'm like, that's exactly right. It was from the era where no status quo has really changed. It was that kind of 4th to 7th edition where everything just kind of stayed kind of stale.
The books themselves, I mean, this is no slight on the authors, but the books themselves didn't have as much weight, style.
Yeah.
As the ones we have now, like there has been a dramatic shift. And so if you have a holdover perception from that, please check out the books now. Even the 40K Absolutely. Novels are just night and day difference.
Well, I remember I'd read a bit of like fluff, Sicarius fluff from like 5th edition or whatever. And I'd just be like, oh yeah, okay, Sicarius overcomes the odds, wins, didn't even struggle, didn't break a sweat, all is well. Okay, fantastic. What was the point in reading that? I could have just read his bios, like his character sheet. Oh yeah, Chaos Icarus, overcomes all the odds, always wins, all is well, never breaks a sweat. Sweet, cool. But then I read Dark Imperium, or from when kind of 8th edition launched, and it was about the resurrection of Gilliman and him coping with the changes to the Imperium. That was really well written, especially that first holy crap, that first chapter where it's him versus fighting Demon Fulgrim. Like Demon Fulgrim's cornered him, he's got him dead bang. Gilliman cannot win in an open pitched battle against what Fulgrim's brought. And so the only thing he can do is try and lure Fulgrim into a mono, e.g. what happened with the Vengeful Spirit and the Emperor versus Horus. And unlike what happened between the Emperor and Horus,
hey, no Gilliman gets...
everyone knows what happens. Gilliman gets messed up and ends up in cryo for the next 10,000 years because Fulgrim is a butcher and he's a freaking demon. And Gilliman hasn't got the powers. I mean, he was never one of the most powerful of the Primarchs fighting-wise. I mean, he gets his ass handed to him by Angron and a couple of others, but he was the most well-rounded, Him and Dorne are like the most well-rounded of the diplomats and politicians, the leaders, the policymakers, and they're also warriors and, like, you know, great strategists and tacticians. But in one-on-one fighting, they're not always the best. And so he knows this.
Especially against another Primarch, right? That's where they could potentially have a misstep against a different set of skills.
And so Gilliman goes into this fight against Fulgrim pretty much knowing he's stuffed, but this is the only way he can do it without losing all his men, all the people who follow him, all his serfs and models and people who run his ships, and just they're all going to get destroyed if he doesn't have this, like, last roll of the dice and just see if he can pull it out. And he doesn't. He gets chopped up. He gets chopped up pretty good. And a lot of his men get chopped up good, and they get him out of there, and they all bail away and somehow make it out of the battle. That setting of the stage there was stupendous, and that told me everything about the shift in writing styles, because that was a very much a Horus Heresy writing style, where lots of big pivotal things happen, and they showed you one of the big pivotal parts of the scouring. So that was what was happening. So Horus had, at that point, like, you know, Fulgrim's already a demon. Horus has already fallen. The Codex Astartes has already been written. The reforms are, you know, happening. But Gilliman's, like, he's losing. He's still losing. Like, he's out there, like, still kind of getting his ass kicked. Like, and I just love that. I love that. That brought so much more flavor and interest to the Ultramarines than I'd ever had before. And it started me seeing him as a fallible entity, someone who has character, who has depth, who has something worth buying into. Whereas I was reading Chaos Icarus, and I was just like, I don't care what this guy does.
Well, I guess some of those old 40K novels were, Pulp Fiction might be, like, the best way to describe it. I mean, some of the, because it was just, this is, you know, a novel, a story about, you know, crazy over the top war type things happening with these to showcase some of the mega superhuman or stuff. I mean, I think the back then Eldar novels were a little bit better. They focused a little bit on some different things, but, you know, whatever. It's now completely different.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. I wish they would, I'm of the opinion, I wish they would continue with pushing the envelope as they did in, like, Gathering Storm and the start of 8th edition. I feel like they've gone back to their old ways of, like, nothing real, no real big shifts changing for a bit. But I mean, it's only been, like, what, 2 or 3 years. So I can shut up, seeing as I went through, what, 15 of, like, nothing changing before this. So.
Well, I mean, you know, yeah. So, sometimes just gotta bite the bullet, gotta weather it, you know, whatever. So with these things, I know we jumped around, but the Blackstone Fortress, with this being the end of the Blackstone Fortress, I guess, set of stories, you know, it's definitely not going away. The game itself, Warhammer Quest, it's the Warhammer Quest, you know, line. We'll probably see more stuff with it.
Yeah, I mean, these, I love the War of the Worlds-esque aesthetic that they've got going with these drones.
Yeah.
From Blackstone. But it really is evocative of War of the Worlds, isn't it? Well, that's how it feels to me.
100%.
The whole scary, creepy, alien tripod thing.
Yeah, completely foreign to everything that we know right now.
Such a brand new aesthetic in the game as well, which I think is fantastic, because that is what the Blackstone Fortresses are. They're kind of, no one really knows how they got there. They're kind of like elder tech.
I love the lore. I love all that stuff. Like, they've been a point of, like, imagination, like a imagination magnet since the dawn of them.
Yeah. Agreed. Man, I Warcry, yeah? I've got a challenge for the listeners. Sorry to segue.
Oh, no, so this is the next thing on the list.
Yeah. Someone show me a bad Warcry sculpt. Yeah. I haven't seen one yet.
We'll wait.
I'm not convinced one exists.
Pause yeah, someone, the show. Go look.
Someone try and find me a bad model they've brought out in that range. Because I'm looking at these guys here. I'm like, damn, they're great.
Yeah. What we learned in the preview from Eddie and Adam was that that's not the whole range. It's not a 3-model warband. There are 10 to 12 of these guys. And these are just complete throwbacks to the Dark Elf range.
Yes. But, like, brought into their own, just, like, fully fleshed out. I mean, you look at the face on the I don't know what the main character here is called. She's got that big flowing cape of what looks to be, I don't even know what to call that.
Well,
it looks like kind of an energy.
What they were talking about, and this may just been the description, I don't know, had anything to do with it, but, like, these capes might be living shadow. Real drow-esque type dark elf thing.
But you see that head? That head is Cabal-esque from 40K, like a Reaver head with that flat, emotionless mask, which I love that aesthetic. I think it's so good.
Agree. You've got the Daughter of Cain type headdress on there with the real I guess, nod to the Reaver head, like you're talking, which is the best head. I think if you can put that head on many things, you probably should.
Yeah, for Dark Eldar, I just think that head is. It gives you everything. They don't care about you. They don't care about you so much that you don't even need to look in their eyes as they're killing you. They don't care. You don't matter. Yeah. It's so good.
This dude that looks like the assassin with the double crossbows.
A double crossbows.
I question.
I hope he holds one of them sideways.
Yeah, I question his pants choices.
he's out for a night on the town from the look of his pants choice.
He's definitely in line at the club. Tough. I mean, for being, have probably the build of an elf or whatever. He looks real tough, and those repeater crossbows are just. I mean, that was what the old range was known for.
It was. It used to terrify me playing Dark Eldar in fantasy and just being all like, oh, cool. I'm just going to get shot and get shot and get shot. And if I'm lucky, a third of one of my units will make it to you. And when I get there, you've got always strikes first. You get to hit me first anyway. Hilarious.
We've joked around in the past about picking up a lot of dice and intimidating your opponent with, how you roll them all at once. Mm-hmm. That's actually from one of the old Dark Elf. I think it might have been like third or fourth edition's Dark Elf army book. Where it told you specifically to pick up all the dice for your repeater crossbow unit in one roll and roll them all at the same time because you
would intimidate
your opponent.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's what a dark elf would do.
Yeah.
It's so good.
they mentioned this is just three models out of the set. Like there are, mm-hmm. 10, 12 for the warband. And they point out this is like the first ones that aren't like some kind of chaos oriented thing. Like they've had, the cards that let you play the other factions in Warcry, but this is the first Warcry specific models that are not chaos worshippers or direct chaos worshippers.
Yeah, that's actually pretty true. I'm not as up to date with Warcry as I'd like to be. All I seem to do though is just sit and admire the models when they come out. Just be like, it's another
that's okay.
Legit sculpt.
That's still there's nothing wrong with part of the hobby. That's fine. That's fun.
That's true, yeah. I mean I look at them and there's who are the crow? There's the crow.
The Korax. They're basically like Corvix Koraxes or something. The raven. Yeah, the raveniest of ravens of Raventown.
Yeah,
in the state of Ravenshire. That's what they
Quoth the Ravenshire mayor of Raventown.
But I'm only joking because I can't hate on them because they're beautiful models. They're probably one of the best model ranges, like set of models that Games Workshop has.
Agreed. They are beautiful. Yeah, but see, those are the ones I look at those and I'm like, I just want to paint you. Yep. I want to paint you like one of my French girls. They are beautiful.
no doubt. Let's take a quick break, then we'll come back. We'll go through the rest of the preview and then do a little 40K talk.
Fabulous.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, we are back. It's still me and Adam.
Still me and Paul.
Yo man, so I mean, folks, we're obviously recording this at a different time than we normally do because this is after the preview, and the preview was a Saturday morning my time, and just after midnight your time? Or
11 p.m. Yeah, so more than late enough.
Yeah, so now we're recording after that. Adam's still in the future. I don't even know what day it is where you are right now, but
it is later. Sunday at 11:15 a.m.
Nice. So the next thing up on the list is the Age of Sigmar Lumineth Realm Lords Sinari Cathalar.
Yeah.
All right. So
Sinari Cathalar. I don't know. I don't know if you pronounce the C.
The paint job on this model is magnificent.
I agree. There are some techniques they've used here that I don't know how they did. So that always pikes my little intrigue buttons.
Absolute sorcery. Like I have no idea how they painted the veil with the face. Like if that's not the first tutorial they release, good luck. No one else is ever going to have this model, looking this way,
Yeah, exactly right.
But so she's obviously like a spellcaster or something. HQ got the giant headdress, which seems to be like the MO of the Lumineth Realm Lords, who worship the almighty Beaver of Secrets.
Beaver. the Porterhouse of Power.
Yeah, there you go.
I think destruction. I don't know.
If you are able to finish the entire Avatar in one sitting, you get it for free or a T-shirt. I think.
I think that'll be that's fair.
but the headdress has got the upside down moon, which what they indicated, you know, which if you think about it, is one of the Hoeth symbols, you know, that was Teclis.
Yep.
And then the veil, I mean, it looks like she is wearing a veil. Like, it is covering your face. You can see it. You get exactly what's happening. This gossamer type fabric in front of her face.
Yeah.
I mean, again, I have no idea how it's done. Zero.
Well, the only thing I can think of is painting the face, and then you got to do successive glazes and stop. Exactly when you're meant to stop.
Yeah. How
I'm
much?
I'm very bad at that, by the way.
Yeah. How much Athony and Camo Shea do I have to put on this model to make it look good? That's what I want to know. How much?
Yeah.
The answer is zero of that. But like, what is? How can I null this into perfection? I don't know if there's a way.
Yeah. Well, if I was gonna guess, I think the green is Kolia green shade, or it's Drakenoth nightshade, and they've Lamian the crap out of it to like it's literally water, and you just paint on the water till you get an effect.
Let's take a guess. I'm willing to bet that this is contrast paint with probably three bottles of contrast medium.
Well, so that I was going to say that would be the skin underneath. I think absolutely just looks like white with one or maybe two light coats of contrast. But then over that, I think is actually just a glaze shade over white. I think the gossamer kind of green blue tinge they've got there. I think that's just a couple of shade glazes.
Has to.
And I say shade glazes to cover my bases because I don't know if they use a shade or a glaze.
Those are
I
two
say
shade separate glaze. Things, by the way.
But they're two completely different things.
It's a shade glaze layer paint base.
It's a shade glaze layer paint base. Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure how they do it, but I think they use the shade glaze layer paint.
John Madden.
You kind of cup your chin and just nod, and just nod at that guy. She's like, "Oh, this guy's an idiot."
but the chalice also looks awesome. I mean, the chalice has got some kind of smoldering coals in it or whatever, but the smoke coming off of it, it looks like, you know, like a universe. It looks like there's like the stars, like a night sky almost. So, I mean, obviously mystical and magical, right? But
sparkly. I actually thought it was gold in there. I thought it was gems and gemstones and stuff.
Okay. Yeah, maybe it is.
Yeah. Maybe. Who knows now? I got no idea. Yeah.
Elf magic, man.
The souls of the gold. Yeah, the gold soul.
Yeah, that effect looks a little bit more attainable to me. I think that's actually possible once you just know you can do it.
That's most of the battle, isn't it? Just knowing you can do it.
Yeah. But anyway, it looks awesome. This skill involved in making this model look amazing. Yeah, it's all there. I'm digging it. I'm getting called to the loop. I mean, I like to play the elf factions in general, even the space elves in 40K.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not taking much to keep my, you know, my attention on this army. I will also worship at the altar of the beaver.
The altar of the beaver. That's still so good. He's going to have a, his avatar should be called Mighty Brisket or something. Mighty Brisket, avatar of the cow god. there's just so much fun there. Much fun to burgers. Gets burger references in. Patty.
There you go. Blood Bowl was next up on the list, and they got the Snotling team. So Snotlings, always real popular.
Mm.
Oh, I don't like you. You don't like Snotlings?
I love Snotlings. Sorry, I was just pulling it up. Give me a moment, Jesus. Yeah, they're so good. Wow. Well, look at the dude on the stilts on like the peg legs.
So they refer to it as basically playing Blood Bowl in hard mode, which is interesting because I mean these guys. I mean, you know they're gonna have dirty tricks, I guess. So every it looks like half of them are armed with secret weapons that aren't so secret. You know, that's the thing about Blood Bowl is you get to bring something out, absolutely just mug one of your opponent's figures, and then you get ejected from the table. So if I had to bet, I think the Snotling player is probably going to need two boxes of these to keep recycling your dudes, your players back out.
Yeah. To the get pitch. The dustpan out.
But the pump wagon comes in the set. That's not a standalone add-on thing. So you get everything that's here.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The
box.
The pump wagon is, I've got two OG pump wagons at home still.
The original metal ones.
Yes. Yeah. And I've got all the little dudes. I've got like a bag just full of snotlings that we, you know, because each one you'd stick like 100 snotlings on it.
Yeah.
And it's still snotlings. Cool.
So yeah.
Well, that was pretty easy back in the day because no one really cared. You're just like, green them, dip them, stick them on, paint the teeth if you care.
Yep. I agree with that. That was the washes really helped you there. But yeah, the pump wagon, the old metal pump wagon, for a while that was like a chase figure. You couldn't get that over here in the States for a pretty long amount of time. You had to mail order for it from the UK.
Yeah, it's so weird how that stuff. You think about that stuff now, and it seems so foreign that would be a problem to have. Yep. But yeah, that was something we all lived through.
Yeah, but I'm digging this. The look of the pump wagon, obviously, it'll be a plastic, so it'll be much easier to work with. But with Blood Bowl, you know, they talk about, you know, being on hard mode, but that's the kind of way, you know, it just takes, sometimes you as your own player do more damage to your troops than your opponent. So, you know, I think this is going to be just fine.
Well, I just love it. I love Blood Bowl. I think Blood Bowl is one of the best rule sets. Has one of the best cult followings of any game. I mean, there have been whole other companies that have picked up Blood Bowl and made Blood Bowl because they know the cult following that it has. I think firstly, it's just very interesting.
We did a live show this week, and it's on YouTube. So if you haven't checked it out, please check it out. We're doing like some cold launches of that where we're working out the bugs. I think we're just about there. Adam, you weren't on that one, but you'll hopefully be on the next one.
Yes, fingers crossed. My working arrangements have changed a little bit, so I'm going to have to be mixing it up. Keep things fresh.
Yeah,
and
we'll
involved.
So
we'll figure it out.
But it was we talked a bit about how it's the reason, one of the reasons that Blood Bowl is so streaky is because it's got that older kind of die roll mechanic where you're rolling many, many fewer dice than you would in today's type game. And so you can get those dramatic swings a lot easier where you get your doubled self knockdowns when you're rolling two dice. Mm. Even when you have a massive advantage, you're still only rolling two dice. You take yourself out what seems to be like 50% of the time. It's at odds or whatever, but it just feels like a lot more.
I just like it's a game you can play competitively, but you can't get, it's like there's almost an inability to get butthurt. But that might be me being naive, by the way. There might be plenty of butthurt going on.
It goes
on
both ways. No,
but,
you do feel bad.
Exactly.
Yeah, you get real feel badsy, but then your opponent does it the next turn. You're like, you know what?
Exactly.
The universe is right at itself.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Yeah. Yeah, and the games are nice and quick. You can smash out, you know, you do a best of three with your mate just before lunch, and then do another best of three after lunch. Like,
well, it's a timed game, so the actually you are timed, and if you go over your time limit, you're penalized, and it switches to your opponent's turn.
Yeah, and they throw you in the crowd, and the crowd ravenously tears you apart.
It is the worst thing to get pushed in the crowd. But you know what? I bet the Snotlings aren't going to care about any of that. They're not going to care about being ejected. They're not going to care if they get one of them killed or whatever. I mean, maybe if you got a bunch of star player skills on one, you know, you don't want him to be in harm's way, but you probably paid next to nothing for the gold to get him there. So, you know, whatever. Easy.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly right.
Interested to see how these play.
Yeah, same. What's the next one? Ah, we got Tarvis.
Okay, so Saul Tarvitz, apparently, and I didn't know this, but his original mention was in one of the, like, the epic computer games.
Apparently, like, 1988 was what I heard.
Oh, sorry, in the Space Marine rulebook. So that was, it wasn't the computer game, that was the epic board game. That was actually the first game I think I bought, like box set I think I bought at one point in time. So obviously I didn't read that part, but I didn't know he was a throwback to there as a captain.
Mm.
But this guy, I mean, obviously a fan favorite because of his actions in the Horus Heresy, the novels.
Yeah, I will have a little bit of a gripe, if I'm allowed, Paul.
Yeah.
His face is the only gripe I've got.
What?
I can't tell if I love it or I hate it.
I thought you were going to say that he's holding his sword by the blade and his hilt's in the wrong place. And I was like, you know what? It is.
That is exactly true. Actually, I didn't even notice that. I was too busy focusing on his face.
I think his face is great.
Yeah.
It's got this... I mean,
they've done a good job. There's a lot of character in that face, in that expression.
The face looks to me like what I would consider an emperor's children. You know, it takes a lot of pride, a lot of care in what's happening here. But the face looks like it's got this depth of like worry and still resolve there, and then ferocity, knowing what he has to do. That's what I see. That I see that all in that face.
Yeah, I wonder who he was modeled after, because a lot of these guys are modeled after real life people. Is this Fabio? is this Fabio? Like,
he definitely cannot believe it's not butter.
He has no idea it's not butter. He can't believe Fulgrim thinks it's butter. He's willing to die for it as well.
Yeah, I mean, his actions. Yeah.
All of a sudden, I can't stop looking at the sword now. Thanks, Paul.
Look, the sword has apparently got some good rules. I mean, this guy's got rules. He's had them for forever, and they hadn't had a model. But I think this model is great. Like, look at the shoulder pads. Just, he looks to me, you know, grander than most of the other Marines, but it still all looks like proportional. Like his armor, his head, it's all very proportional, and he looks tougher to me. Like, he looks wider, broader, like he could hold the line.
Yeah, I agree. And if they managed to make an Empress Children just look beef. Yeah. Beef, but still Empress Children.
Yeah, it's got everything there that I think that they indicate that the Emperor's Children were before they started to fall.
Mm.
I'm down, man. Look, I got no complaints. I don't even care how he holds his sword. Like, look, he's obviously a great swordsman. He faced off against he killed Lucius the Eternal. Like, and that's like, and he's not the only person that's done it, right? But that is, it's like plasma pistols in 40K. That's how they judge how good you are. So if you are really awesome and really competent in the 30K, you've killed Lucius the Eternal.
That's actually amazing. Okay, yeah, I'm down with that.
And I think there's only three people that have done it.
Who's the others?
So Sharrakhan Norwyn from the Raven Guard.
Yep.
And Loken. Loken beat him. He didn't kill him, but he beat him.
Mm.
In combat. Gavril Loken.
I can't believe we don't have a Lucius model, actually. That's interesting. So we've got two Empress Children models apart from Fulgrim. We've got Eidolon, and we've now got Tarvitz.
Yep.
There are no others, are there? The Eidolon model is still fantastic, by the way. Like,
he
has one of the coolest thunder hammers that they've ever made. It's got like clawed teeth thunder hammer. It's just sick.
Oh, wow. I do like their pre-heresy color scheme. Like, it's a little blingy for me, but that's exactly what they do.
That's exactly, yeah. Yeah.
And for a minute, it like took me off. Like, why? Okay, look, I can promise you that I'm probably not going to wear my name, my own name, on my banner. But I'm like, you know what? I bet an Emperor's Children would.
You mean you're not going to make a Space Marine chapter in the future called TPM?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't. But my captain wouldn't, you know, if his name was Paul, would not have Paul on the, you know, on his head, his banner, his back banner or whatever. Like, you know, Loken's not going to wear a name tag.
No, that's true. Loken wouldn't do it. He's such an interesting character, Loken. He's a good dude.
Oh, yeah. That was going back to those first four books are amazing. Just glued to every page type. Amazing. But Saul was a big part of that. Like, you know, we all knew that Garrow was going to get away in the Eisenstein.
Yeah, there was already enough fluff. And, well, firstly, mostly because I didn't read the books as they came out. You know, I read them after there was already 10 books out. And I started on False Gods. And so by then I knew Flight of the Eisenstein. And people were always,
was in the original, like, two pages of story. That was the Eisenstein showed up in Earth, warned the Emperor of the betrayal.
Yeah.
And, you know, seven of the former Death Guard were there or whatever. We all knew that. The cool thing, though, in the story that we got expounded is like, it's kind of interesting that at that point in time, like, Garrow still never made it, or he just wanted to get to Earth or to Terra, and he didn't get there. He got taken away and sent to the moon instead, you know?
Moon. Yeah.
So it was like, oh, just so tragic for the character still, you know?
He was the first Knights Errant, yeah, who became the Grey Knights. It was him and Loken and who else formed that?
If people haven't, if people haven't read Barry Dagger, I don't want to get too spoiler, spoilerific. What's that?
I didn't even know that was. I haven't read it. I didn't even know that was a bit of it.
Barry Dagger is the last book, quote unquote, in the it's not quote unquote, but it's the last book in the Horus Heresy before the Siege of Terra.
Mm.
And there's that's a lot of the book in there, and there is some. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. So again, no spoilers, and it's definitely worth. If you thought you could skip it because you didn't like the you don't really care about the Death Guard because. You know, for whatever reason, there's a lot of Death Guard stuff in there for sure, but there's like almost like an equal part talking about what you were just talking about, and it's worth reading.
Sick. So Malkador forms it, yeah?
I'm not telling you anything.
Oh, come on. That's like, I know Malkador forms it.
Yes.
Like, it's his chapter. I haven't read the book, and I know Malkador formed the Knights Errant.
Okay. Oh, yeah. He definitely formed the Knights Errant. Yeah. Just check it out. There's nothing happens quite like you think it happens. Or I shouldn't say that. There's some twists in there that keep it interesting, but still don't feel like they're just trying to be shocking or whatever. It's neat stuff. But we all knew, going back to the Eisenstein, we all knew that the Eisenstein got away and... for Miss Von 3 and everything's going to kick off and there's no going back or whatever. But hearing all about Saul and the way he behaved and did all that stuff. This is an epic character.
Agreed, man. He's an awesome character.
Yeah. And I think he's got a model that does him a lot of justice. It's very akin to the Alexis Pollux model. Like that model does him a lot of justice too, I think. Like
that's actually very true.
Ton of that character in that model. And this is, now look, the character series are great. Like Karn's awesome. There are some better models in that range. And I think this is right up in there in that echelon of that.
I agree. Past that, it's starting to become very apparent. The age gap between some of these Horus Heresy models. I may have touched on this before, but if you go back and you look at the first two, what I recall is the first two they released, sorry, some of the first two they released being World Eaters and Sons of Horus. Those sculpts, while still thematically amazing and holding up, they are starting to look a little bit older when you can tell that they were, so you can tell Saul's been computer generated and sculpted. He hasn't been hand sculpted like the old ones were. His face is more fleshed out and proportionate, where you see some of the old faces, they're either a little bit too slim or their eyes are a little bit askew. Off in,
like,
in
we're,
some
we're
way.
Talking about Loken, but I'm willing to bet that Loken's model next to him would look almost like weedy.
Yes, I was about to say, and proportionally, like I'm just looking at his calf. That is, he's got some beef calves on his on
skip leg day.
No, there is no skipping of leg day. Yeah, but like I mean, Abaddon is a good one for this. Let's have a quick look at Abaddon because I remember Abaddon is still a stupendously fantastic model.
Yeah,
and I actually love it. I actually look forward to owning it one day because I still have this dream.
Yeah, they're good.
I still have this dream of doing a Sons of Horus army as they were as the First Crusade. Because I think I've told you how I fell in love with Black Templars as they were during the First Crusade, the First Black Crusade. I would love to do a pre-Drachnian Abaddon Black Legion.
Yep.
And so and use this model as, you know, this is Abaddon as he emerged from the warp for the first time in 10,000 years to ravage the lands of men again.
Oh,
and
cool.
Yeah, it would be cool. But Loken's head, Loken's head is a pretty good one. You look at Loken's head versus Saul's head, and you can really see the age difference. The definition in the lines, you know, in the creases and the age markings, and you can tell this guy's been through, you would have to assume that Loken is a lot younger, even though, like, they're probably not. They're probably quite equal in age gaps in the fluff. Yeah, it also looks like Loken's been, like, punched in the eye a couple of times, which by then he probably had been. Like,
he's fighting Abaddon, that is way deep into this.
He's taken a couple of orbital bombardments to the head. You know, he's a bit out there. I never noticed that before. But yeah, he looks a bit malnourished.
But see, that's what I'm talking about compared to where Saul is at right now. Hopefully, we get a Knight Errant model of Loken that gives some beefed up to this stature eventually. Yeah. But I mean, everything about this model I like. I'm talking about everything. Like, it doesn't even bother me that obviously they designed their own weapons and stuff. Like, he designed this with some kind of purpose. I don't, I, I don't know why one would do that to a sword.
Yes.
I mean, who knows? By the time he's fighting like this, maybe he's so tired he needs that extra leverage because he's already walked maybe through a mile of traitors, just wearing them all out.
How long did they survive in the fluff? It was a couple of weeks, wasn't it?
It was a month. Yeah, that was a long time. Because they do, I can't remember exactly how it worked, but they went like from city to city on the planet. So there was some time involved with their before Horus was like, you know what, virus bomb the whole thing.
I think I had a little bit of disbelief at the time because it took them months to start using the Titans. And they're like, oh no, we've held out for like a month and now they're starting to use the Titans. I'm like, wait, so you had these like Warlord and Reaver Titans literally just sitting there twiddling their thumbs watching?
Think about it. It takes, I mean, like, let's talk about, because you got to follow the money, right? You know, like, it's easy to think about there's unlimited resources for this kind of stuff, but that's a part of the game across the whole way of how do they bring enough resources to Terra? And if they had to expend that Titan then, they might not have had it later. And they didn't know at that point in time that half the Titan legions were going to fall. I'm thinking, look, I'm going way too deep, I know, but that could have been what they were thinking.
Well, I always thought it was pride. It was pride and
that's probably the better answer.
Yeah, well, so I always assumed they were trying to make it out that this was the pride of the legions. The legions were, this was their vice. This was their downfall in the fact that they wanted to be the ones to kill their brothers. They wanted to be the ones to lock off and either prove to Horus that they were that they had the resolve to follow through, or like Angron, he just felt like butchering his own dudes and didn't want anyone else to have the fun.
Well, I think that when it's been some years since I've read. I read them when they first came out, but didn't Horus like almost get fearful is a bad word, but concerned that Angron exposed himself to possibly getting lost on the planet.
Yeah, as he was pissed off that Angron went down in person, and he was all like, "Just leave it to the dudes, like just send in the next wave." And Angron was like, "Nah, I got this."
Yeah, but I bet he was worried. I mean, again, I'm maybe misremembering, but worried about losing Angron down there because he wouldn't have had him to bring against Sanguinius at one point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
I mean, I don't know. We're real deep into.
We're well deep in the quagmire of books that I haven't read those books in a couple of years. So I'm always kind of constantly reading a Horus Heresy book, but I haven't gone back to the original trilogy in quite a while. So yeah, it might be a bit remiss for me to speculate on the motivations of a arch nemesis protagonist, whatever. Because he kind of did straddle the two, didn't he?
Which one?
Horus. In the first three books, if you were just reading those books and you didn't know. If you didn't know, like, well, of course, you'd probably read and be like, ah, oh, these books are about this guy called Horus. And they're in the Horus Heresy series. Oh, that's interesting.
We knew what was going to happen, right? Like, that's what makes it so impactful.
Yeah. Like, theoretically, if I could suspend my disbelief and, you know, I didn't know what's going on. Horus comes across as like a benevolent, like, father figure throughout pretty much the whole three books until like the last two thirds of the last book.
Yeah, that was difficult.
Yeah, False Gods and Horus Rising. You're still like, he hasn't quite dropped off yet. Like, he seems a bit iffy, but he could just be, you know, could just be sick. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, what if this changes everything? I got to keep reading.
Just that first line, though. That I think that is the best opening line to anything ever.
Yeah.
I was there the day. Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
Still. Yeah. Ridiculous.
Completely agree. Well, I think that, you know, getting this back to Saul, I think this model definitely does the character justice. And if you're a fan of the Legion, this model is a must have. Like, you can make this guy a praetor or anything in your army. Like, you don't have to paint Tarvitz on the back of his thing. But I think this is a must have figure if you play Emperor's Children. And heck, you could probably swing it for lots of other Space Marine chapters. Like, you know, the shoulder pad is modular. And it wouldn't take much to scrape the third legion off. Heck, he could be captain of the third company in whatever your Space Marine army is.
So who comes after Saul? So we've got Psychic Awakening Pariah being announced, which I think is going to be the last Psychic Awakening book, yeah?
No, I don't think. We got Machine War, More of the Machines. There's there's more. I don't know when we're getting I don't know what the order of release is.
Yeah, but those have been announced. You know what I mean? So I was thinking this is the last one. So we've still got Machine War, we've still got War of the Spider, and we've got Pariah. I think that's it. Now that we know that they're releasing, was it Death Watch getting their White Dwarf release? And was it Harlequins? Who was the other one that said they're getting White Dwarf released? I think if they've got Custodes, Sisters of Silence, and you know Inquisition, assassins in Pariah. I think that's about it, isn't it? That's under the assumption that Machine War has both sets of knights, Chaos and Imperium, demons, and AdMech.
Yeah,
and that's the assumption.
Quick calculation
made there.
Says that maybe that is, but I know we talked about the Inquisitor model a little bit earlier, which is again can't. I love that humanoid models for 40K. So I'm sure I'll get it. Hopefully, pie in the sky. You know, hoping that I get to use them all in one force at some point. But Illuminator Zaraz from the Necrons, man, talk about this guy got some.
Talk about an upscale.
Yeah, he's definitely like, got a Primaris juice or whatever.
80% more man in this pack.
Well, they talked metal. About them that he's got a thing on his back, which is a piece of Blackstone Fortress. It's a knocklet
or
something.
That's sick.
And it's got the ability, you know, one of his abilities is to cause people to peril on any doubles within 9 inches of him for psychic test.
Yeah. So I know you remember the days where so for those who don't know, Pariah used to be an old Necron model. It used to be a Pariah, e.g. they were similar to a Lich Guard, whereas Lich Guard uses a war scythe. They had a scythe as well.
Yep.
And their whole shtick was that they had the Pariah like anti-psyker field in them, which they had the Necrons had developed to fight against the old ones, who were very psychic based, and as were their progeny, the Eldar and the Orcs and stuff, were all very psychic tuned based. So the Necrons built these Pariahs to be like nulls, and the Imperium stole that technology and used that to create Kalexis Assassins, and also into a bunch of other bits and pieces. I'm a big fan that they've come back to this for Necrons, because this is a big reason why Necrons were actually able to win the War in the Stars, because they had these Pariahs, they had these things that would null the warp, and because the warp is anathema to them, like it's the opposite of what they want, and they have no psychic resonance as a species. So I love that they're coming back to this. I've always wanted Necrons to have Pariahs again, and I've always thought it was a bit of a shame that they lost it, because it was such a so evocative of their fluff. And then when you get down to like, and that fluff has been right through all of 40K. You look at the Fall of Cadia, the pylons that kept the Eye of Terror from expanding were Necron. They were Necron in construction.
Necrons built
it.
Okay.
Necrons had it. They've always had this null, this ability to not mold the warp. They can't mold it, but they can put a plug in it.
Was
they
that confirmed, like, or is that your speculation, Necrons?
No, that was confirmed. Trey's in the Infinite came down there, and he started doing the work on them, and he was on Cadia, and so the Necrons had a bit to play in that story, because they built the pylons and they had to activate them and keep them going and all this other stuff. I can't quite remember the specifics. Yeah, so they've always had this warp nulling tech, which goes all the way through their fluff, and it's always been a shame, especially on the battlefield when you play Chaos as Necrons, and you're like, I should have a solution here. My fluff says I should have a solution here. There should be a thing that I can do in this situation. And you crack open your decks, and you're like, I have this one Warlord trait that I can take that gives me one deny.
A little spider or something. If it was in the right spot, and in the right, you know. It's not saving you from warp time as well.
exactly right. Like, you got one deny. Okay, my opponent brought seven smites, and I've got one deny. I think I'm stuffed.
Yeah. That's I was talking with a little bit about this buddy today. That what's his name? Zaraz here is messing this dude up on his base.
He's devouring his
whatever
soul.
He's doing. It looks horrific. But as the guy, my buddy was like, "Man, it's only 9 inches. I don't know if I like it." And I didn't go into it because he doesn't really play competitive, and I didn't feel like having that discussion with him. I'm like, "Man, but when you roll up against, you know, any of these smite spam armies, you are going to make them think twice about doing their trick."
Yeah,
and that's strong.
When you think about space, like, especially first one that comes to mind for me was Grey Knights. They all just want to be all those little strike squads. They want to be deep striking within 9 inches and getting off their smites and their storm bolters. Now you're pushing them back maybe to 12 inches. So even if they're going to be deep striking outside of the range of this having an effect, if you're making their charges longer through deep strike, that's still a really worthy cause.
That's a great point. Yeah. Yes, absolutely agree with that. I had not thought about that. That's a great point. So just having this dude on the table, I mean, you know, he's going to get we have to suspect he's going to get new rules, right?
Yeah. Everyone has. Everyone is like, you know, look at Ragnar. You've got a new model, got new rules.
Yeah.
Gazcool, got a new model, got
I mean,
new
this
rules.
Guy's, I don't even know if the guy's still, I mean, I guess he was, right? Still in the Codex. It's been a while since I looked. We talked about like Necrons have a billion special characters, and I couldn't remember if he was in there or not. But, you know, he's got that little fine cast model now, you know, on a 20 millimeter, 25 millimeter, 32 millimeter base, and now he's jumping up to what looks to be a dreadnought base.
Yes, he looks huge, dude.
Yeah,
I really like the model. I like all the nice special effects and things they've got as well.
Yeah. So I can't wait to see how they did that too. But yeah, this, I mean, if you look at the human scale of the model that he's jacking up, then he's massive and probably going to get some rules commensurate to that.
Hell of a unit.
Yeah, and it's neat that, you know, what you're talking about, bringing in that lore from this. And I mean, I don't know that we'll see more units, but we might see more strategies that allow them to exist in that phase, compete in that phase.
I just wanted to have more of a say. It's pretty much where I was going with it. It's not that they shouldn't. There's zero. Same with Tau. Yeah, I don't think Necrons or Tau should ever have psychers, but I am a fan of them having some ability to have a say, like some interaction there. Because right now, you just get to have your way with them.
Well, your point, yeah. But the Tau, I mean, they've got enough shooting. Like their super shooting equates to them being able to skip a phase. The Necrons don't have that right now. Like what you have to rely on with Necrons is rolling sixes and hoping you get some. Basically, that's it. Rolling sixes, hoping you get to exist for a long period of time.
Yeah.
If you're not
and with. Yeah, and with Krons, well, so a difference to Tau is that so Krons have a significant shooting phase and can have a significant melee phase, whereas Tau don't have the option. Tau just have that one phase.
Yeah.
Did you have a good shooting phase? Oh, that's your turn done. Because Lord knows you ain't got nothing else going on.
Yeah, but I think the Tau got enough that they can deal with it. But
Yeah. By all means, I'm not a Tau sympathizer, but I'm more of an all around. I like to try and keep my eyes open and an open mind about.
No, yeah, fair enough. But I think the Necrons could benefit a little bit from that that extra. I mean, maybe not. Again, competition probably is a strong word. So fair point there. But being able to exist, to dabble in that phase, even if it's just defensively, so the armies just don't run roughshod over them.
Yeah. Yep. Agreed.
Yeah, but whatever, man. This is a beautiful model.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah. I mean, this is probably the best Necron model we've ever seen.
Big call, but I agree. Yeah. I actually, maybe a non-Forge World. Those are the Forge World Centipedes. Love them.
The Forge World Centipede is not better than this model.
I would say it's on par.
Okay.
I've got a soft spot for that model. I love it so much.
All right. Yeah. We talked about the Inquisitor, like I said, but then the next thing we got was the Warhammer Storyforge, and I'm a huge fan of where they're going with this. I want to consume this content. I mean, that's kind of, there's no other way to say it. I want to watch this. I want to watch what they come out with, and I hope it's awesome. And I like this style of animation.
Yeah, I'm a big fan as well. I like this kind of gritty. Yeah, I like it. I like it. There's not much more for me to say apart from I like it.
Well, I mean, I'll have to... stuff like Castlevania on Netflix. I've really enjoyed that. Right. This is kind of evocative of that. It's in line with some of that going back to like Liquid Television stuff on MTV. You know, it's definitely it's like a modern heavy metal almost.
Big fan. I'm hoping it's as. We'll have to wait and see how the story lives and dies, because naturally, like, the animation is like the gets you the buy-in, but it's the story that keeps you enthralled and encapsulated in what's going on. So yeah, I think I'll hold that judgment until I actually see the finished product, but I like what I'm seeing so far.
Oh yeah, I no idea what the story is or how it's going to be strung together, the pacing, like even like the Ultramarines movie that they put out now, what, 20 years ago or whatever at this point, was, I mean, it was even written by Dan Abnett, and I still wasn't like super thrilled about it. But you know, whatever. You know, I'm really looking forward to this and want to see how it's all. I want to consume this content. So then they put up two models, like the event only librarian for sale, and then a brand new, something I didn't expect, a Sister of Battle model. No shock to anyone. I bought both these models as soon as I could because they're awesome.
Nice. The models are fantastic, man.
Well, I mean, Terminator librarians, like, how many do you need? I don't know.
It's true.
But I have a Grey Knight army, and so I don't see them getting the Primaris treatment anytime soon. And they definitely use Terminator librarians.
Yep, absolutely right.
And then the Sister of Battle is Tariana Palos.
She's
just a sergeant. Fantastic. She's not even like a character model or anything. Just basically a squad upgrade. And I was like, you know what? I've dabbled in the Sisters of Battle while I've been doing some hobby store purchases recently. So I can't not get this.
I don't think you can't not get it. I think I think she's magnificent. I think she's perfectly been perfectly transposed from the art to a real life figure, and I think it's a magnificent model. Yeah, I'm not so keen. I'm
out of this world.
Yeah, I'm not so keen on the librarian. Like, I mean, fair enough. Cool, it's a librarian, but yeah, she's fantastic.
Yeah, they said they absolutely not. I will never be able to recreate the way they've done this black or how it blends in with the robes. Again, that's a little bit of a painting sorcery as far as I'm concerned, but I'm going to try. I'm going to do what I can. So
yeah,
got it down to the scar on the face. I mean, it's awesome.
I'm just reading this last bit. And so this warmer preview comes to an end. Did they tell us when the next warmer preview is going to be?
It's in a few weeks. It won't be next weekend, but it'll be in a few weeks.
Early May when you can expect to see your next preview. I wonder if did they give us any spoilers? What we're going to get?
None. Got nothing.
They didn't give us any drip feeds.
Nope.
Nah, that's cool.
So yeah, I promised we'd talk about 40K, and I hinted at the beginning of the show that you probably have some thoughts on movement and stuff. And we were talking about like how the satisfying just thrill of side flank and rear charging people.
Mm.
That kind of stuff. Like, you get that same satisfaction when you lock people down in charges.
Yep.
And there was an amazing article. What the Warhammer community team has been doing during this time. I don't know if they've been publishing more content or just had some spaces to fill because maybe people were out or whatever. But they've gone out and solicited people in the community to write some things. I took something on Space Wolves. I don't know. We talked about that a few.
Yeah. Who was this guy who wrote this one on the charge phase as well?
So one of the folks from Goonhammer did a charge phase article, and it goes into some of the things that we have discussed on ways to own that fate. About how your movement's not over after you've made your charge roll and things like that. Like there's all, you then go into almost this like sub game in the charge phase. And if you really at least understand that, even if you're protecting yourself from it, then you're going to have many more wins for the game in general, right?
Well, I always talk about the charge phase. Sorry, not the charge phase. Sorry, the movement phase being the only 100% your phase. Like there is no interaction with your opponent. So Psyche phase, they can deny or they can roll dice. In every other phase of the game, apart from the movement phase, your opponent can roll dice. Literally, the movement phase is the only one they roll zero dice. It's all you. And so for that reason, I think it's the most important one. It's the one that's I think you need to get right the most. And it sets you up for everything else you do. So, and to your point, like the charge phase can be seen as a second movement phase for a lot of armies, especially armies that have like extra consolidations. I know there's been a bit of talk on the top tables at the moment of Tyranids, and they have all these extra ways of getting super consolidations. Things like Hormigans, they mm-hmm. consolidate 6 inches and stuff.
When one unit can move 40 something inches in one turn, potentially.
Like, yes,
you got to be on the lookout for that.
Exactly right, and. That's just giving them another movement phase. And at the same time, like, ergo, in the charge phase, you charge a Tau army. That's giving a Tau army another shooting phase. So you kind of have to break it down into thinking as simplistic as that at some points. But at the other point, sometimes it's just really simple. Like, for an Orc player, sometimes charge phase is really simple. Like, your whole movement phase, shooting phase, everything was there to set up your charge phase.
Yeah.
And so, therefore, the charge phase becomes the pivotal one where you don't want to mess that up. Because if you don't get this wrap with these orc boys, they're just holding their things in the wind and they're going to get absolutely demolished next turn. But, e.g., if you do your charge phase right, all of a sudden you've got 30 orc boys in your opponent's lines that they can't shoot. The status quo of the game completely changes. A whole new level of problems have just been laid upon your opponent.
It really does. And here's where I have to get a little bit beardy in my comments and my advice. As this type of terminology like tri-pointing and wraps and hostage taking and that kind of stuff becomes more common in the vernacular, then people just assume that they know how to do it or can do it. They just say, oh, I'm just going to wrap you or you're wrapped, right?
Yes.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
And this is where I've got to get a little bit beardy, and then this is no slight on anyone. You make them do it. Okay, cool. Move your models the way you want to do it. Like when you're playing competitive, if you're playing casually, you're in your basement, or if it's game night with your friend or whatever. Like whatever. You can just assume that kind of stuff. But if you're playing it competitively, where there's some stakes or whatever that might matter, you make them move the models.
There is a technical skill and there is a precision to the movement phase and to the charge phase and to the positioning of models and miniatures. And if you're playing a competitive game, I mean, maybe flag it with your opponent saying, hey, is this a competitive game? Do you want me to hold you to the line, or are we going to have or is it going to be a bit of leeway? Because if it's going to be, I want to know now, But if there's not going to be like Euro, there is an expectation that if you can't just say, oh, I can do it, so I have done it. You must show me that you can do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Demonstrate that to me, please. I mean, because I've been in several situations, you know, if last round of a tournament, like, oh, I'm just going to lock you in. I'm like, okay, cool. You know how far you can move. I mean, I'm not saying get down there and get your tape measure out and be like micron measuring him. I'm not saying go that far, but like, yo, move the models. And then after you've moved your models, the best you can, the max you can, then we're going to assess what the state of things are. And, you know, I'm not going to be overly complicit to my own demise here. You know, like just you do your thing, move your models, do what you're supposed to do. And then we're going to take a look at things. And then if it works out that way, that's the way, you know, there's nothing I can say. But don't just concede that he gets to throw out a term or they get to throw out a term. Be like, yo, you're right. You got me. Like you gotta demonstrate it on the table.
I totally agree. On top of that, like I've played 40K at the, I guess what I consider the top level, that being like the world team championships, you know, representing your country and all that stuff. I'm guessing like it could be conceived that things like the LVO, the super majors, playing on top tables there can be the peak of the game. But to me, like playing for my country is the peak of the game for me. At that level, like it's not good enough to just say, oh, I can do this, therefore it's done. If you don't have the skill to do it and the nuance of positioning to say you've tapped somebody, you try telling somebody through like a foreign language that you intended to do something, they don't care. They're gonna be like, nah, man, you didn't do it. Sorry, brother, you didn't do it. They'll get the judges over, they'll point to the table, they'll get their coaches over, and you'll lose that argument every time.
Well, the physics take over. It's like, well, can I move my model to where he says I can't? Yes, I can, or no, I can't. And there's like your intent in that situation doesn't mean anything, like just like you said. But look, I'm not saying play this way all the time. I'm saying when the stakes are there, you know, make sure that you make them demonstrate it to you.
Well, when it's worth it to you, you know, if it's worth it to you to do things properly, then the onus, you know, you should hold your opponent to the same degree, as long as they're aware of that. I mean, I'm not saying pull gotchas on him and say,
nothing like that.
But like I'm one for all having a clear understanding of what's the expectations of a game when I go into it. Like, what are you expecting out of this? Are you expecting a very tight, very clinical, very to the book rule, or is there flexibility? Because I'm happy to play either way, and I enjoy the game either way.
Same.
Technically, I do enjoy with some take backsies here and there. Like, and if you state your intent, if you state your intent and you're able to do it, I'll move the models for you. Like, as long as it's very clear that you're able to do what you can do. If it's iffy and you know it's not certain that what you're trying to do is possible, I'll ask you to come around the table and do it and show me, because I'm not. Sometimes I might I'll be like, sorry, I don't understand what you're trying to do. You might have to come show me, because I mean, and that's perfectly reasonable.
Yeah,
to expect.
Anytime a model is trying to get around the back of another model and do something, you know, you really need to kind of precise it out. You know, and that's what I find. Those are like the warning signs. Like, yeah, you may be able to do it too. And I don't think asking your opponent to play precisely is a gotcha moment at all.
No, absolutely not.
You didn't indicate that, but I mean, that is something that I think that you can feel. Sometimes you don't feel confident or like you're in a position to where you can challenge what they're saying because the game's going pleasant up until that moment. You know, but I think that anytime you're doing these, like it's very technical. It's a very precise thing. And the people that master that, and there are masters of this out there. They win a lot of games because they can see how it all comes together and move in those ways that deny you it's going to deny you your shooting phase. One of the core concepts of, you know, how we talk about competition is you're controlling the momentum, and that's what this allows you to do. But, you know, as these things become just like catchphrases or whatever, there's an art and a real technique to doing it that has to be demonstrated, in my opinion.
Yeah, I totally agree, dude. Well, I just think that if you have a plan and you have a way that models should be moved and should be used, you should practice those and make sure you're competent enough doing it under any circumstances. Like if you're an army that relies on wraps, like orcs rely on getting wraps, so does Gene Stealer Cult rely on getting wraps, and so do a huge variety of other armies. If you are not confident with tripointing, practice.
Yeah,
get your models out on your kitchen table
on
and practice
size bases. So practice on a 32, practice on a 40, practice on a 25. You know, it's a little bit different.
Yep. Yep. And just getting the muscle memory down, just getting the components locked in into your brain will make a huge difference. And then when you get to those crux points and your opponent puts the pressure on and says, well, not to put the pressure on, but ask you to demonstrate your thinking and say, hey, you want to be able to do this? Please show me how you were going to do this, because I need to see it. I need to see that you know how to do it. And you'll just walk over and just go, bang, 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 done. If I give some examples of ways to practice this, practice being 9 inches away and rolling a 9, and then you've only got, you can come like one or two guys get within the 1 inch, and then you've got 6 inches to get your 3 inch consolidate and 3 inch pilings. Well, always getting closer to the closest model, get around a model, get some wraps in, et cetera, et cetera. Or work out how many, like, let's say you've got because what I used to do is I used to interlock guardsmen units because they're on 25 mil bases. You can interlock, you can go one guy from one unit, one guy from another unit, one guy from another unit, and like that. And that's a good way people have of defending against tripoints. Practice against that. Put like 10 orc boys into that and see how many attacks you need to put in to start plugging holes in that lattice work of guys, so you know how you can go through. And that, of course, that it does, it's actually really that's actually really problematic for orcs, because you have to be on 30, well, a lot of places make you be on 32 mil bases with your orc models now. So yeah, getting down and just getting down and dirty and doing the stuff, just practicing the stuff you need to do to win games.
I did the same thing with flyers back when flyers, you know, if you went off the table, you were, you know, it was a lot easier to force yourself off the table, you know, back in the day. I did a lot of moving with flyers that like I had pre-programmed where I needed to deploy my flyers every single game to be able to do what I planned to do with them. And I practiced that on an empty table by myself, you know, just moving flyers around.
I think it's a big deal. And I think I'm not sure it's something that gets spoken about enough, but especially flyers are a perfect example. I played a 6 flyer list for Dark Angels a couple of months ago. Yeah. I had 3 Nephilims, 3 Dark Talons. That list was putrid, by the way. Like I didn't lose a game playing that list when it, like, unnerfed. I didn't drop a game playing that list before the Doctrine Nurse and stuff came in. That army needed, I'd never played that many flyers before. I'd only ever played with like 1 Valkyrie or a Vendetta or 2. In the past, those flyers are a whole lot bigger. Like, the footprint of a Vendetta is bigger than the footprint of a Baneblade. Like, and trying to keep that on the board is actually a bane. These Nephilim stuff, they're a lot smaller, but there's a lot more of them, and they get in each other's way, especially when you need to bubble them up around a Dark Shroud turn one. And so, you know, you're all starting all clumped up within, like, I had 2 Dark Shrouds to give them all extra minus ones. Starting them all, like, in a defined place, and then not having been in each other's way, and some can hover, some can't, some move further than others, and blah, 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 different weapon stuff. It took a whole lot of thinking to try and get them working at their optimum level. And yeah, like at the day before the tournament, I was with my mate staying at an Airbnb. I got all the bases out. I got all the models off the bases, and just got the bases out, and just got the measuring tape out, and just started doing some measurings. Because the last thing I wanted to do was get to the table having never used that many flyers and lose 3 of them turn one because I just goofed, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right there with you, man. Well, that was it, man. I think it was a great article. This is not even like a cautionary thing. When this stuff comes up, you obviously don't want it to happen to you, and it's harder than it sounds to do it.
Mm.
And so just be aware and then make them go through the motions. And sometimes you just can't get there with movements, or sometimes you are just boned and you gotta take it. You gotta figure out how to get around it. So.
On top of that, I just want to say, if you haven't checked out Goonhammer, check out Goonhammer, guys. They are not only are they a great set of dudes doing good works for the community, that's a fantastic resource they've got out there for all levels of the game. Like, just from the hobbyist just starting in to, you know, how to get started to how to play things at their absolute optimum levels. Big fan of Goonhammer. Check him out if you ever can.
Yeah, 100% agree. Would like to talk to him sometimes. Heck, we'll get him on if we can. Talk about their philosophy of how they're coming about some of their stuff. Okay, so that's it for our show today. Please check out our sponsors. I mean, that's one of the things. Please like, share, subscribe. Remember, we're going to be doing some live cast, and I'm going to try to get the information out now that I think we've gotten a little bit closer to making it something that people might want to tune in for.
Yeah, so, almost worth listening to.
Getting there. So close. But you can see us too. You know, that's video stuff. But
yeah, it's true. Yeah, not that I do definitely have a face for radio, though. Just put it out there.
Adam, thanks for coming on and making some changes to our recording schedule this week. We'll be back to normal next week, I think.
Yes, hopefully.
All right, man. Have a good rest of your day.
You too, mate. Take care.
See ya.
Make my day.